Violence in churches and violence in schools is something we've heard way too much about over the last 5 or so years. It's always horrible and devastating when we hear this news. But did you know that the first time a gunman entered a house of worship and committed mass crimes like this actually happened? A little over 40 years ago in a small East Texas town, ironically called Dangerfield, Dangerfield, Texas. This was the first time this kind of violence happened. A few years ago, I made a documentary feature of this story and in this town called Faith Under Fire. It's a powerful story. It's not a story that focuses on the violence that happened. It's a story about their journey that took 20, 30, even 35 years to come out of. It was a slow healing process to overcome the trauma, to forgive, to walk through the test to their faith. It's an amazing story of what these people had to overcome and their triumphant victory over it, I guess I would say. You know, sometimes when these really awful things happen in our country, it takes a while before we can really look at it and learn from it. For example, 9/11 was 20 years ago, and I still can't watch a documentary or a movie about 9/11. It's just still too painful for me. But the story of Dangerfield happened long enough ago that we can now look back on it and learn from them. And believe me, they have a lot to teach us. Today, I'm going to show you the first half of this documentary feature, Faith Under Fire, and next Sunday, we'll air the conclusion to this story. If you watch it today and you don't want to wait a week, I welcome you to go to our network, heartstonenetwork.com, click on Faith Under Fire, and you can watch it. You can also share it. It's free to watch. I hope you will enjoy it. I hope you will share it, and I do hope you'll learn from us. Let us know what you think of the film and what you learned from it. I'm Sondra Hartstone, and I thank you for joining us today. Enjoy the film. On September 15th, 1999, a crazed gunman stormed into Wedgewood Baptist Church in Fort Worth, Texas, armed with 100 rounds of ammunition and a homemade pipe bomb. 7 young people were killed, and 7 others were wounded. Since that day, there have been over 620 deadly force incidents in church and on faith-based properties, resulting in over 420 deaths. It breaks my heart to know this type of violence is escalating. 72 fell victim in 2012 alone. Evil has indeed entered our sanctuaries. But what many may not remember is the first time a gunman entered a house of worship in the United States and committed mass murder. It was 19 years earlier, on June 22, 1980, in the tiny East Texas town of Dangerfield, a town centered around community and family, a slow-paced community of just a few thousand, but they're tight-knit, where everybody really does know your name, and where everyone took that day personally. It's been over 30 years, but the pain and memories for those affected that day are still very real. These survivors witnessed and endured what too many are having to deal with today as this violence continues in our churches, schools, shopping malls, movie theaters, basically everywhere. They have not only survived, but they have learned to walk with courage and with faith. We've all heard that time heals all wounds. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but I do know it takes a generation to pass before the pain has subsided enough for us to look back and learn from it. The time has come for those in Dangerfield, and they have something to teach us.
remember, after church today, we gotta wash your hair, okay?
Hey, Jeff, look at my giraffe.
Hey, Jeff, what are you doing down here?
Oh.
You playing with your toys? Alrighty, we're fixing to have to go to church.
The lion is kicking the closet.
Oh, he's kicking it? Okay, Ninja, turn around.
Good morning, Dangerfield. Well, I don't have good news for you this morning. Looks like the heat wave is going to continue, and there's no promise of rain in sight. Pilgrim Farms reporting the heat wave is killing the chickens. If things don't change, this will be one of the driest summers on record. The high temperature is expected to be 105 degrees. Hope this doesn't mean it's going to be a terrible summer. Stay tuned for the weekly broadcast of services from the First Baptist Church of Dangerfield coming up at 11. This is Cody Stutes for KEGG, Hometown Radio, Dangerfield, Texas.
I gotta go get Jennifer ready for church, okay?
Okay.
I need you to sit here and watch Jeff for a minute, okay?
I was preparing to go and lead the music at the First United Methodist Church in Dangerfield on June 22nd of 1980. I had been a pastor for more than 14 years. Gina would go 1 week with me to the Methodist Church because I was temporarily filling in for until they got a permanent music director. And then the next week, she'd go back at our home church, the First Baptist Church.
She really had a little game going. I don't know if she even realized it, because when she'd come to the Baptist church, she would get a little postcard from the Methodist teacher that said, "We sure missed you. Hope you'll be in church Sunday." Well, then, when she'd go to the Methodist church, she'd get a little postcard from the Baptist teachers.
It was about, probably around 9:30, something like that, in the morning. And I made my way down the steps, and, you know, the door didn't shut behind me. And I turned around, and there stands Gina. And she says,
"Daddy, can I go to church with you?"
I said, "Gina, you know, this is your Sunday to be at the Baptist church." Boy, I've thought about that a lot. It wouldn't have hurt anything for me to have said yes, load up, get in this truck, go with me. be great.
Gina had always wanted me to walk with her to her Sunday school class. But that day she turned around and she looked up at me as to say, "See you, Mom." I said, "Okay." I said, "You know where it is." She was growing up. So I took Jeff and Jennifer to the nursery. And then I went into my Sunday school class.
I'd never taught a Sunday school class before. And what was so unusual about it, it was about death and bereavement. I believe that was the title of the lesson. And I never had anybody die close to me, and it just didn't resonate with me. I didn't have that story to tell.
I thought, I didn't really like that lesson because I had never really lost anyone close. They just kept talking about how God would give you strength to get through, you know, a hard time or losing a loved one. And I can remember looking around thinking, I wonder who this is for. It's not for me.
So I just put everything I had in teaching this Sunday school lesson, as I always do. Being a lawyer, I ran a little long. We were late leaving. And as I was leaving, Cheryl left. And as I was going through the door of my room, she came back. And I'll never forget as long as I live what she said.
I said, "You know, I've never lost a loved one, and I could never think about it, and I can't even think about losing one of my children because they're the world to me. But I know now if something ever happened, I can handle it because of what of our lesson and what he had brought out, you know." Well, anyway, not knowing that in about 20 minutes, I was fixing to fully experience that.
Because we were late, when she picked up her little girl, Gina, I think who was about 7, at Sunday school right next door, we had to go in last. And because all the seats were taken, my wife had saved me a seat down near the front. But Cheryl and Gina didn't have seats, and they had to sit at the back.
The things I actually remember is walking into the church, sitting down, Gina asking to sit in front of where we were at, where her friend Stephanie was sitting.
This Sunday, we had the new pastor, and there was an excitement in the air.
Church was full, completely full. And it was a happy day. I'd had a kind of a dark cloud over my head. Seemed like all week long that something was going to happen, and I thought it would be my children.
Well, that day, he wasn't going to be able to be there because he was sick.
Red and I, we were a little bit late coming in, and we always sit about middleways down there.
Mother had went before us to save us a place and to sit because the church was always full. Ms. Richardson came in and asked her to scoot over, and she did. And so when I and my husband come in, we had to get set in front of both of them.
I did help out with the sound system. And I had been working 7 days a week in my building business and actually came home from work on a Saturday. And my dad lived across the street from me, who was a deacon of the church. And as a good father would do, he came over and he shared a story with me about how a businessman in town had a grocery store and he worked 7 days a week and was still having a difficult time. And one of the members of the church went and visited him and had challenged him to close his store down on Sundays and trust that God would prosper his business 6 days a week and if he would honor the Lord on the Sabbath. And so I said, "Okay, Dad, I got your point. I'll be there tomorrow." So in reality, God actually worked through my dad to make sure that he had me in place that day because God knew what was going to happen that next day.
We were sitting there singing more about Jesus. Gina turned around and she looked at me and she smiled real big and she winked at me as to say, "I love you, Mom." And that was the last smile that I was going to ever see.
Everybody, please sit down. Please sit down.
When I am down and oh my soul so weary, when troubles come and my heart burden be, then I am still and wait here in the silence until and sit a while with me. You raise me up so I can stand on mountains. You raise me up to walk on stormy seas. I am strong.
I was 4 years old the morning I witnessed the death and the violence. The images are still playing out in my mind. I wish I could say it hurts less today, 32 years later, but I can't. All 350 of us in the church that day have never been the same. Al King not only took our loved ones that day, he stole our innocence, and for some, he took their faith. But something else happened that morning. We experienced a love like no other, a selfless love that we will never forget. Gina was my sister. She was 7 years, 8 months, 26 days old. I'm Jeff Lynham, and for those of us that survived, this is our story of that day and the 11,718 days since.
You could feel the evil in that church when that man entered, the cold, the dark.
He shot a time or two and hollered, "This is war."
I turned around to see the shot. I saw Gene Gandy fall out of his pew, and of course it was really happened extremely fast.
Had a panoramic view of everything that went on that morning.
I had a bayonet on the end of the gun, and I thought he was going to stick me in the stomach with it.
Brother Fielder said, "Everybody get down, get down." I remember seeing Gina go down, but I thought she was getting down like everybody else. And then Jeff got down and he looked at me with that little blonde hair and said, "Mama?" You know, I think here we are at church and Mama's up under the pew. I know he was wondering what the world. And I thought, "Oh, Jeff." And I grabbed him and pulled him under and laid over him as much as I could.
When he shot me, I was so close. It was right up here. And luckily for me, it shot off my fingers and went down in my arm and just exploded. But my powder burns, my vest was smoking, you know, and it actually went through my vest. And I had those burn places like you'd put a stick of cigarette to your place. And so, but anyway, I fell back.
I told my husband, I said, "I've been shot." I remember him looking at me and he jumped up and went to the bank.
My husband told us to get down, and we got out. My mother and I got down, but Ms. Richardson didn't, and I looked around. She had been shot, and a bullet had come by. I felt the heat from the bullet from as it went by my ear.
And then I was shot again in the back. It knocked me down in the floor.
Chris was sitting at the back. We'd recorded everything in our church, and he was operating the thing at the back, and it kind of on a platform.
Al King did not see him when he came into the church because Chris was sitting to the left, kind of behind the door.
Chris Hall grabbed hold of the rifle, and Chris and Al King were struggling over the rifle, and they fell back into the foyer.
When Chris jumped on him, he lost his glasses and he couldn't see.
My only thought was, this is not right. It has to be stopped. And I didn't count the cost. I didn't look at the odds. I didn't think about what danger that situation would present. He did shoot at me three times and missed all three times.
When they fell, they let go of the M1, and at that time, Al King pulled out a 38 pistol. And of course, when Chris saw the 38 pistol, he was looking for a place to go on his hands and knees. Chris was extremely athletic and very quick, and Al managed to shoot at him as he went to the downstairs that led to the basement. And he crawled on his hands and knees face down, and let me tell you, those stairs are extremely steep.
And I remember the little girl falling out of the pew right there within, say, 4 feet from me, something like that, and blood coming out of her, and so.
Red McDaniel and Kenneth Truitt, they were almost simultaneously charging the door. Al King managed to turn back after shooting twice at Chris. He had gotten to his feet because he shot Red McDaniel twice in the upper area. Actually, I believe it was this side. Their momentum with Kenneth Truitt being right behind him, and Kenneth grabbed him in a bear hug.
And when Kenneth Truitt jumped for him, he pulled that pistol up and shot him.
Red was probably 6'4", 6'5", a very tall, big man. Kenneth Truitt, 6'7", 300 plus. And Al King was probably 6'2", 240. The momentum of them all going together, they hit the double doors, which led into the church and splintered them, and they all three went out.
J.C. Welber and I, we just stood up and we went out the side door of the choir room. Honest to goodness, I don't know what we were thinking. I don't believe we said a word to one another, but we were after this guy wherever he was.
When I got to the back, Larry Cowan was standing there holding on to the M1. It had jammed, and he was trying to unjam it, and he put a shell in the M1 and said he ran around the corner. I'm going to the back to make sure he doesn't come in the back door.
Both of us saw him coming parallel through the street towards the fire department next door, and so we were going to intercept him, and don't ask me what we were going to do if we caught him, but he was well armed. Anyway, suddenly he disappeared, as if though he'd ducked down or something, but we kept on going towards the fire department, which was a hump of dirt that he started up, and without his glasses, I'm not sure that he really knew how the terrain was at that point, but he tripped and went down, and we heard a shot. Now, we didn't see that, but when we got over to him, JC and I rolled him over. And that was probably a dangerous thing to have done, but, you know, we were operating on adrenaline, and gosh knows, it was such a traumatic thing, and he had the gun in his hand, and we noticed in the side of his head just a very small hole, but he was unconscious. And the immediate thought was JC to make sure he didn't get up, so he started to put his foot on his throat. And I said, J.C., I don't think that's a wise thing to do. And I said, I think he's done for.
By the time things had kind of settled down a little bit and get up, all the men are going back that direction. Of course, we didn't know, are there others? Or, you know, what is this like? So they are going around the building, running through the sanctuary to make sure everybody's okay.
Stephanie, her dad had her in his arms, and she would say, Gina, Gina. And she'd look down at Gina, and then she'd look at me, and then she'd look down, and I thought, Gina, oh my, she'd be one of the first ones up, and because she was so full of life. And so I pushed Jeff out, and I ran over there, and I took her by the feet, because I wanted to... I mean, I knew she was wounded, but I had no idea where. And working in the medical field, I know sometimes you can injure them by moving them. But that was my daughter. I had to let her know because, you know, she would always come to me at times. And, you know, and you'd kiss her little hurt, her little bruise, and put a Band-Aid on it and fix it in a way that she'd go. But I knew this was going to be much more than a kiss and a Band-Aid.
My mother led my little sister and I to the front, and I remember kneeling in front of the Lord's Supper table and praying. I just remember sitting there and thinking that this is a significant thing that's going on.
When I took her feet and I gently pulled her to me, that's when I saw her brains all on the floor. So I knew her hair had fallen down over in her face. And I didn't touch her, but she was still breathing. And I looked up at the clock and I said, "Lord, please just roll back the time. I will do anything, just bring her back."
I remember when the incident, after the shooting had happened, Mom getting up, and I was there by myself during the chaos, and then tripping over the arm of an old man. As a kid, that's how I saw it. I saw him laying there with his arm stretched out, fingers gone, and didn't know really what to make of that, so I just kept going.
Jeff came up from the middle pew, the aisle. He come around and he said, "Mama?" And he said, "Is Gina gonna be okay?" And he was as pale could be, because everywhere he looked, somebody had been shot. And then here was his sister. I knew I had to get him out of there. And so I asked Tommy, I said, "Please, please stay with Gina, but I've got to get Jeff out of here and I've got to go get Larry."
People were rushing to the back of the church on that right side to get people from between the pews and ripping those pews up and trying to get to the victims. And I remember looking at Jean Gandy's face. It was just gray, and thinking, "Oh no," it was just awful.
When we walked out, there sat Kenneth Truitt. He was alive at the time, sitting up on the steps, and he had been shot through the heart. But he had his hand up over his heart, and he was rocking, and he was praying, "Oh God, help us. Oh God, please help us." And I was just, I mean, it unbelievable.
I knew something was wrong. Cheryl would not interrupt the services of another church, but I could see this look of horror on her face, and I just looked at her. I said, "What's wrong?" And she said, "Larry, you've got to come quick." A man came in and began to shoot people. And she said, "Gina's been hurt real bad. Come quickly." I headed out the church, and I hit those front doors, and I ran across. And I was there in just a matter of, less than a minute.
And he tried to rush in and get to Gina, and several grown men were trying to hold him out because of her wounds.
I remember them grabbing me, and one of my very close friends, just on my right, said, "Larry, you don't want to go in there. You don't want to see Gina the way she is." And I looked at him, I said, "Boyd, if it was your child, what would you do?"
I said, "Boyd, did Gina die?" And he said, "Yes, Cheryl, Gina just died." I felt like I'd been shot. The pain that went through me was more unbearable than I ever dreamed it could be. And wishing that it was me and not her.
I saw Gina's feet laying on that floor, just sticking out past the back of that pew. For some reason, I just sat down on the floor and I looked at her. And I reached over and I touched her. And it was like the whole, there was no noise. It was like I had entered the holiest place I'd ever been in my life. But I was smelling death. I could smell it.
I remember turning around, walking down the sidewalk, and different people were coming up trying to put their arms around me to comfort me. And I would tell them, no, no, please, please, leave me alone. This can't be happening. And I remember just as plain that God spoke to me. And he said, Cheryl, I know it hurts, but she can't come back. He said, you know, I'm going to take special care of her. I'm going to place a testimony in your heart, and I want you to share it with others because time is short. And I felt a strength come over me that I had never experienced.
I'd never seen so much blood. My wife, she said, everything's going to be all right. And I, for the life of me, I couldn't make sense of that. It wasn't all right. People were going home with their kids that day. I wasn't.
He just sobbed and sobbed over her. I left and went to the courthouse to tell the dispatcher to send ambulances and police.
I turned and went back to the front of the church. Red never opened his eyes, never said anything. Kenneth Truitt, he just said, Junior, it hurts. And I said, where did he get you? And he said, in the side. So I took off my coat, put it under his head, trying to make him as comfortable as possible.
I was the only officer on duty that day. We had a five-man department in 1980. I got out of the car and found Mr. Truitt and Mr. McDaniel, which I both knew personally. One was a city councilman, and one was a retired steel fella. And they both had seemed to be fatal wounds to their chest area. And there was a what appeared to be a 38 or 357 caliber pistol laying beside Mr. Truitt. I proceeded there to the open doors of the church where there was massive crying and screaming, and some call it pandemonium. People were doing the best they could with first aid. There was no ambulances on the scene or anything at that time. And just as I went to the right there by the shrubs to the corner of the church, Larry Cowan, who was a very good friend of mine, met me there at the corner of the church and said, Jackie, the guy's down there in front of the fire department, and he had the 30 caliber carbine in his hands with fixed bayonet, and the gun was still jammed. He turned it and threw it into the ground with the bayonet between right in front of me, and I proceeded to take custody of the weapon.
Jerry Pratt walked up. Jerry at the time was an official at the school. He said, my Lord, said, that's Alvin King. I said, who in the world is Alvin King? He said, he's a teacher. I just couldn't comprehend it. A teacher doing something like that, especially in God's house.
King had wounded himself in the forehead, sending some bone fragments into his brain. Some say it was an accident, some say on purpose. I just say it wasn't enough to do the job right.
One of the officers said, call the chief and get him. And I got there and went inside the church, and I had victims everywhere.
I specifically remember Thelma Richardson. She was laying on one of the pews. She'd received a gunshot wound to the back of her shoulder. I remember specifically picking her up and in my arms and taking her out to the ambulance to put her on the stretcher. So after I know when I got outside the church and put her on the stretcher, I felt like she expired at that time. So I have vivid memories of that. I'll always remember that.
There was over 300 rounds of AR-223 ammunition that was in that ammunition bag that he could have done major damage if that first weapon had not jammed. And I believe he was going to leave as many casualties behind and leave the scene.
That was the closest thing to a war zone, I guess, that you can come into and it not be a war zone.
I checked on one lady, Grace Jones, who was shot through the chest and had a little handkerchief over her wound. And I said, "Miss Grace, you've got to go in the ambulance." She said, "I'm an old woman." She said, "You get everybody else that's wounded loaded up, and then you come back and get me." And she refused to go until everybody else was left. And sure enough, when we got the last ones loaded, she was still sitting there by herself, bleeding. And I helped her up and put her in my car. And I remember all the way to the hospital, she said, "Steve, I'm so sorry I'm bleeding on your new car." And I said, "Miss Grace, don't worry about the car."
I walked up to Mother and I was standing there and I said, "I'm never going to church again." And she said, "Oh, yes, you are." That was scarier than the gunshots. I mean, I don't mean to laugh, but that was really when the fear set in.
I remember walking down the sidewalk, walking away from death, and instantly becoming angry. It was like I'd stepped out of the holiest place I'd ever been into sheer darkness and anger, and just that quick.
I remember this was after the shooting, and like I said, Frank Burke and his wife had taken us to their house.
And we sat out there on the patio, getting away from the media and everything. And
we were waiting for our families to get there. And I know that day that all this happened, it was clear. It was a beautiful day.
I watched this cloud come up in the southern sky. And the closer it got to me, the larger that cloud got. And within a matter of just a few minutes, that cloud was directly overhead and just turned black. I mean, pitch black. And it started raining. But it wasn't just a downpour. It was one drop here and one drop there at the beginning of it. And you could see on the 6-inch tile, ceramic tiles that was on the patio floor, a raindrop would splatter and cover that entire tile.
He said, "Oh my word, I've never seen raindrops that big. They're huge." And I looked at Cynthia then and I said, "The day the angels cried," because it was God's people that was attacked.
We went back up to the church after it had quit raining, and the rain had washed all of the blood where Kenneth Truett and Red McDaniel died.
You know, I've worked accidents where people were killed, and I've worked shootings. Golly whiz, I've worked so many shootings I can't count them all. Nothing like that. Nothing like that.
I never thought in a small town like Dangerfield that I would be involved in an investigation of a random public massacre. Your sense of innocence and tranquility in a small town, it just gets erased in a situation like that.
You don't go to church thinking that you're not coming home with your family.
I can still see it today.
I began that day to prepare myself to murder Alvin King.
I had my day all planned out, so I thought. And I guess, I mean, we never know.
Bad day.
It's a day of mourning in Dangerfield. The latest update on the shooting at the First Baptist Church is 10 wounded and 5 dead. The deceased are Red McDaniel, age 53, Gene Gandy, age 50, Gina Lynham, age 7, Thelma Richardson, age 78, and Kenneth Truitt, age 49. Please keep these families in your thoughts and prayers. Stay tuned to KEGG for updates as they become available.
That was June 22nd, 1980, the day that changed our lives forever.
My father was narcissistic, highly intelligent, self-absorbed. I can't find any redeeming values about the man.
He felt like that he was above everyone else. He felt like he was king of kings.
I believe he was an atheist, but there was just something in him that I never liked. Almost like there was something in him that was being repelled by something in me.
I asked him a question close to the end of class, and instead of answering my question, he berated me, just ranted and raved and said, my little girl that's in grade school knows the answer to that question, and just on and on.
I don't think he had much empathy for other people, much less women. I really think he just disrespected women as a whole.
What I found most disheartening is what happened 3 years prior to his brutal rampage. His home burned to the ground.
My first encounter with him was on the fire at the house. And I knew he did it. And so I tried to talk to him. He's very, very snippety.
And even though Chief Keene and other law enforcement officials suspicioned foul play for an insurance scam, the congregation at First Baptist Church decided to extend grace and their hand of brotherly kindness to the King family.
When his house burned, supposedly, the story was that they needed financial help. You know, when they burned all their clothes and their furniture and everything, so the church did do that.
The First Baptist Church is holding a benefit for the family of Alvin King this Saturday from 10 to 4. King's home was destroyed by fire early last Saturday morning. Donations may be dropped off at the activity building. They will also be accepting donations of cash for the family.
He asked me to fix breakfast, which was very unusual. And he never got up early on Sunday morning. These were two unusual things. And then he asked me to go in the living room, and he brought in some rope, and he said, I'm going to tie you to the chair. And I said, why? And he told me why. He said he was going to go do some damage at the church. And I sat down willingly.
Did you try to talk him out of it?
No.
Was he acting peculiar or really angry that morning?
No. He was just acting like he always did. I'm going to do this, and you don't question me.
When he told you he was going to the church to do damage, did he tell you what kind of damage he was going to do?
No, but I heard him going out and getting guns and putting them in the car. I had a pretty good idea.
Why do you think he tied you up instead of just saying he was going to get a newspaper or something?
He told me he was tying me up because he didn't want to hurt me. And that made sense to me, so. And I probably could have stopped him. I don't know how, though.
What was he going to do after he went to the church, do you know?
No, I don't have a clue.
Boss kind of called me and asked me to go out to his house out there and check on his wife, see how she was, if she was all right. When I got out there, she was in the living room.
She was tied up with duct tape and telephone cord. She had no emotions, didn't seem that she was nervous or anything.
Got her untied and asked her if she was all right. And the first thing she said, how many did he kill?
They did find a note under her after she was removed from the chair.
If anyone read that, you know, and you could see right off the bat what type of person he is, you know.
My name is Ozymandias. King of kings, look on my works, ye mighty, and despair.
She was smart enough to know also that if anybody read it and saw it, that they could surmise what type of individual he was real quick.
The district attorney called me, and then when he told me, I like went into hysterics. I thought he had escaped or was running loose or something. And, you know, I was begging them to please arrest him or something.
Really? What were you afraid he might do?
Come to Dallas and kill me.
It's an amazing story of what these people have had to go through, isn't it? I hope you'll join us next Sunday for the conclusion of Faith Under Fire. And here again, if you don't want to wait till then, you're welcome to go to our site, heartstonenetwork.com, click on Faith Under Fire, and watch the whole movie now. It's free of charge. Blessings to you. I'll see you next Sunday.